This is Subversive, a podcast hosted by me, Alex Kashuta, to highlight hidden voices, uncommon perspectives, and our era's true intellectual elite, the anonymous poster. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so on Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. Thank you and enjoy. Today, I am joined by Henry George. Henry is a freelance writer out of the UK. He holds an MA in War Studies from King's College London. And he's been published by pretty much every one of your favorite outlets under the sun. Welcome, Henry.
It's great to be with you, Alex. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm really glad to have you on. You are one of the few people that have been on the show that has the honor of having met me in real life.
Yeah.
We actually have met. We both spoke at NatCon Brussels, which was my first NatCon. And
same here. Yeah.
And it was a really good experience. And it was an interesting place to be. And now we're going to speak at NatCon again next week.
Yeah.
Which is going to be confusing to a lot of people here, because this will air probably in a few months, because this is part of my pregnancy stash. So this will come out a bit later, but it's been a while, and I'm very excited to go to London and to go back to my former stomping grounds in London.
Yeah.
And meet up with lovely people like you. So are you personally as excited as I am about NatCon?
I'm apprehensive. I was less apprehensive last year because it was in Brussels, so there weren't many Brits in the audience. So this is a bit more, you're sort of speaking to your home crowd, so there's a slightly more pressure in that way. But at the same time, I think it's going to be interesting, because the sort of ferment that's been going on the right of politics in America and Europe hasn't really happened to the same extent in the UK. I think the conference brings something that's needed, exchange of ideas and different perspectives that don't often get talked about in the mainstream conservative spaces. There's always controversy around these things. So there's already been some sort of things about, it's nationalism, it's bad. And I saw you tweeted out that tweet by some loony lefty about how we're all basically Nazis who are going. So, that should be fun. But I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to seeing you in person. And the panel you're speaking on about, what is it, about biopolitics? Is that the subject?
Yeah. I have an enticingly named speech called Accepting Difference.
Yeah, I was thinking, that sounds intriguing.
I had to vet it first. I actually had to, run it by Yoram Hazony first. Yeah. And he was like, "This is okay, but tread lightly." I shall tread lightly. Very hopefully. I mean,
it's not just the culture. It's also the fact that if you say the wrong thing, you could get arrested. So,
It might go against the Equalities Act, but I'm just visiting, so I'll be out of there before they know it.
The Equalities Act is something that's been debated amongst the conservatives since it was passed. So, yeah.
And it should be. I mean, debated, not much, but abolished maybe. that's pretty much my point. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, this is just, the opinion of a strange foreigner who's going to go home a few days later.
Yeah. So he'll be able to escape from the clutches of the thought police.
Exactly. Who cares about me?
Yeah. No, but yeah, I mean, the title of your panel and the other ones that are being, convened is shows that there's some fertility of thought going on that isn't necessarily always talked about. So I think it's it could be hopefully quite productive. I think there's going to be some, shall we say, incoherencies. Some of the headline speakers are much more right liberal, as we say in our space, than speakers on some of the panels. So I'm speaking on the second day, hopefully all being well as usual with my condition. Speaking about national conservatism and the common life, which is what Christopher Lash talks about a lot. My speech isn't going to be kind to the Conservative Party, because, bluntly, they've been in charge for 13 years and it's all gone to rack and ruin, to put it politely. So, and I think there's debate within the right in the UK over the role of the nation and the role of economics, and there's a big divide between more libertarianish people and more communitarian, as a cliche, but less individualist. And I think that's going to be on full display at the conference, which should make it stimulating, you know, to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, that's been the theme pretty much for every NatCon. But I have felt the gradient going more towards post-liberalism. I feel like in Brussels, there's kind of a sprinkling of post-liberal type thinkers. And now there's definitely at least, you know, double the number, or, you know, even more, like a lot of the panels are, you know, clearly not Reagan inspired.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the economics panel, for instance, is, I think there's only one sort of Thatcherite, Reaganite kind of person, whereas most of them, it's about, most of the other people I've seen writing about, you know, not whether to have an industrial policy, but what kind. That's the difference. It's just an example. And on the panel I'm speaking on, it's not whether or not to have a national vision of conservatism. It's how to put that forward and how to sort of articulate it in a way that makes sense for where we are today. So, yeah, the debate's definitely moved on.
Yes, I saw some of the keynote speakers. I think that there's also kind of a lot of the people who are still quite prominent on the right in the UK do have a little bit of a libertarian bent. I think that was an important angle for Brexit as well, like, you know, the sovereignty, the right of kind of being able to decentralize and make decisions. So like the people like Daniel Hannan and people who were fairly prominent at that time. I think that's also a good marketing in the sense that, you know, they're coming for that and they're leaving, you know, with whatever we're selling, hopefully.
Yeah, quite. Yeah. I think that divide is representative of the divide within the Brexit vote itself, and it still goes on the rise in Brexit at the moment, because most people who voted for Brexit didn't vote for some global Britain libertarian paradise. They voted for more cultural and economic security and stability. Whereas the vision that someone like Daniel Hannan or Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's another MP, or David Frost, who's also speaking, their vision of a let it all rip in terms of free markets, free trade, free movement, is much less popular even amongst Conservative Party members. And, you know, that's a small number in itself. So I think, and they tried to, you know, Rees-Mogg and David Frost, they tried to sort of steal a march on the conference itself by writing a piece about how NatCon was, you know, appropriate for the UK and this is how it's going to be. And they specifically said, you know, this doesn't mean we're going to have industrial policy or subsidies or tariffs. You know, it will still have the free market and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think there's going to be that. The argument that's been playing out for the last, how long is it now, 7 years, I think it's going to be brought to a head in some ways. And I think that's a good thing because it's been, because of events, it's been swept under the rug too much and pushed aside. And I think it needs to be had out, because otherwise it's going to be, the right is going to keep being incoherent and it's just going to not provide the way forward that we need to actually, you know, whether things could be turned around is a question, but, you know, at least mitigate what's been happening.
Have you felt in the right in general in the UK that things have been moving into more of a kind of a post-liberal direction? I mean, is there more of a movement, a culture? There are there magazines or there things? Because I remember 5 or 6 years ago, it was all pretty much, you know, at best some Thatcher nostalgia and very much kind of Reagan-tinted glasses.
I mean, I wrote a piece for a blog that's sadly been not up anymore for the Mallard, called Leave Thatcherite Conservatism Behind, because, you know, that Thatcher retreads was pretty much the trend on the rise, even, you know, several years ago, despite the different electorate that Boris Johnson came to power on the back of, much more working class, less economically liberal. So, yeah, I think there's, maybe there are green shoots, maybe, you know, maybe, I'm one guy and maybe I'm too pessimistic, but I think there's still the money. This is always the problem. The money behind things is still very much in favor of the Thatcherite consensus. But on the other hand, there are magazines like The Critic, which I've written for, who feature a more, as you say, post-liberal perspective, national conservative perspective. And they're not being completely cast out into the outer darkness anymore, which is what used to happen. And I think in some ways that's just a reflection of the changing reality. You know, conservatism, you know, people in the audience will cringe when I say conservatism because they think that's just, you know, conserving what the liberal order produces, you know, yesterday. But, you know, traditionally conservatism was about reflecting on what the reality was and sort of adjusting to meet it, not clinging to some outmoded ideology that is divorced from things as they are. So I think the momentum, shall we say, is moving ever so slightly towards our side, which I think that will meet where people are, because, you know, I know you have, I know you're not a massive fan of democracy in general, but in the UK, I think where voters are is actually even more to the right socially than the Conservative MPs, as is shown by research. You know, lots of data shows this, but they're less economically liberal. So that way of doing things is going to, you know, if the Tories want to stay in power, which, you know, I don't think it's likely now, given everything that's happened. But if, you know, if they want to come back into power at some point, they're going to have to appeal to this electorate. And that electorate is much more in tune with, I think, our sort of national conservative side of things than the, you know, David Cameron, George Osborne, liberal Tory vision, which was basically, someone said, the only thing conservative about it was being cruel to disabled people. So that was about it, really. And being progressive on social issues, which weren't really very relevant to the direction of the country. So, yeah, I think we have some potential. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that's right. I think, you know, there are two kind of strands of critique of democracy. I mean, one is that, you know, the people aren't unfit to rule. And like you said, in this case, that might not be the case. Or, you know, maybe a deeper and more black-pilling critique of democracy is that things are not as they seem. You know, the people put up to actually represent the different strains of ideas are all kind of avatars of the same thing. In this case, liberalism, you know, from the left and the right. And the fact that the Tory party like clings more to liberalism than the desire of the people tells you a little bit about how this works. And yeah, I think...
I mean, this is the thing about whether ideas or structures and institutions and networks take precedence in driving social, political, cultural change. This is something that you know, I've written about quite extensively. I think there's a writer called James Davison Hunter who wrote a book back in 2010, I think it was, called To Change the World. It's about Christianity in what he calls late modernity. But one of the chapters at the beginning is about how Christianity actually came to dominate the Roman Empire, Western Roman Empire, towards the end of the third century. Basically, his argument is that it wasn't just because there was a critical mass of people who believed a certain idea and that, you know, swept along a change which was adopted by the institutions. It was actually Christianity being adopted by elites who were not in the ruling class itself of the empire, but were close enough that they had influence on the status of Christianity as an idea, as a belief system. And once these people were able to cycle into the ruling elite, they, you know, the fact that they believed this new religion gave it the status that then appealed to the rest of the population, which then, you know, Christianity had been steadily sort of growing for, you know, a couple of centuries, but it hadn't taken off. But once it had gained, to use a Gramscian term, institutional hegemony, it exploded. And, you know, this is the question I think we on the right have to deal with is, how much of a role does institutional change play, and how much of a role does mass politics play? So I wrote a piece for The Critic a couple of months ago, looking at the role of ideas and institutions. The title was, I was trying to do a play on words of the old Andrew Breitbart, you know, culture's downstream of politics. Politics downstream of culture, sorry. And I actually reversed it. I said, you know, politics and culture, they interplay, because sometimes, you know, obviously culture can influence how politics goes. But on the other hand, you know, there are many, 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 many examples in political theory and political history where politics and law are the teachers and the movers of cultural change. So judging between the two is a matter for the virtue of prudence, you know, sort of cautious judgment about what is appropriate for the time. And that, bluntly, is what states, you know, statesmen are for. That's how you judge their merits, is do they, you know, are they able to act in the world as it is to drive the change that they believe is needed within the confines of the structures that they inhabit. So, you know, it's not just the battle of ideas, you know, the shibboleth about the battle of ideas. If we win the battle of ideas, everything will be okay. Well, maybe, but, you know, we've been battling in the battle of ideas for, you know, almost 10 years now, and it hasn't got very far. I think the role of institutions and the networks of people who believe certain things in the structures of power, that needs to be thought about as well.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, because, yeah, there's a lot of people have takes on this. Obviously, the Breitbart take is that politics is downstream of culture. Lot of people kind of in the NRX space say it's, you know, law is upstream of both culture and politics. And yeah, I think kind of, you know, you identified the linchpin here. It's essentially a culture imposed by a elite or counter-elite that's important, and will be important in the long run. I think that's, you know, that's a lot of times what our space feels like, and that's why I feel like it's quite a sensitive time, because things change quite fast.
I just had a note of caution, because I said in this piece, I gave some counter examples of where, in the particular case of Poland and several states in America, where, you know, the elites that we're talking about cycled in, change things, and particularly change the abortion laws. But then, as a result, the public was in such a different place that in the democratic system they were operating in, it actually had the opposite effect to what they intended, and actually had a backlash, which then impeded their ability to do other things. So I'm not saying that one shouldn't try to implement one's view or one's vision for the good, at all through the structures of power, but this is where prudence comes in. You need to be sort of realistic about what can be achieved with the way things are now. You know, and this, again, people will say, oh, well, that's just a reason, you know, that just sounds like an excuse for doing nothing. And well, it's not that. It's more just about being realistic about what can be achieved with the way, with the situation as it is.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it also highlights an asymmetry between how easy it is for the left to implement things and how hard it is for the right, because essentially the challenge for the right is to reassemble things that have decayed through entropy or accelerated entropy, which is essentially what the left is selling. You know, if the left is telling their client classes that the best thing to do is to eat the seed corn, and they've been eating the seed corn for a lot of time, for, you know, decades now. The idea that it's easy to just show up and say, actually, no, we're going to lock the silo now. I'm sorry, guys. that is a much tougher, much more challenging, and much more abrasive thing to implement. You know, talking about abortion law here, I mean, essentially the same thing happened recently in the U.S. I mean, you know, kind of epical situation with Roe v. Wade. No one expected it. And it has created a backlash. It has, you know, put a lot of conservatives in hot water.
In several states where it was, you know, the law, it wasn't about Roe v. Wade being overturned, wasn't about outlawing abortion federally. It was about returning the power to decide such an issue to the states themselves. Several states where that was the case then took a vote on it. And actually the people went, well, actually, no, we don't want to ban it completely. We actually like it the way it is. And this is in, I'm not going to say the specific states. I think I mentioned them in my piece because I don't want to get it wrong now, but this situation happened in a couple of conservative states where you would think it would, you know, be automatically sort of supporting the ultra purist conservative ideological line, which maybe we might be closer to than other people, although I'm less so. But the point being that, you know, this power was returned. The elites in the state legislature went, right, now we can implement our vision. Let's ask the people, you know, because they vote with us. And then the people went, no. So what do you do then? And, you know, some on the near-reactionary right will go, well, you just impose it. You know, maybe I'm too much of a squish, but, you know, the level of coercion needed, I'm not entirely comfortable with.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, the neo-reactionaries, especially kind of in the vein of Lord Yarvin, would probably say that it's impossible to impose it if
that's true.
Would not allow it. Like, it's, you know, the idea that essentially Yarvin has been against, you know, things that, you know, like what Chris Rufo or DeSantis have been doing, essentially using lawfare to impose more conservative standards over corporations and things like that.
I mean, again, I think Yarvin's mistaken there as well, because, you know, Chris Rufo hasn't been, in some ways, Chris Rufo has been working with the grain of what opinion is. And if Rufo has been working outside of the Overton window, he's not so far outside of it that people don't want to move towards him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think people, like, for example, constituencies in Florida would move towards him. But, like, for example, there is the Florida New College. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Both
exactly,
students and faculty there were definitely not in Rufo's camp. Probably maybe a minority, a very small minority of them would say, okay, yes, we want these changes. And barring, you know, gutting the whole faculty and administration and getting new students, I don't necessarily know how the rules that they're imposing are actually going to, you know, find fruition in the actual institution. So that's a tough thing. You know, you essentially need to convert these people on a, you know, religious, you need to catechize the everyone into your cult. And that's why I think this whole, you know, preparing a sort of counter-elite thing, and that's why I think it's so sensitive. You know, there are a lot of true believers of what we speak about online, and some of them are, I know, kind of real people, well connected in the real world. How much of a critical mass this is, you know, what time is it in the scale of the, you know, the counter elite? Is this going to be the counter elite, or is this just, you know, a storm in a bottle, or is this something completely important? So I don't know. It's very hard to tell. I personally am fascinated by all of these conversations and this direction, but, you know, I'm not wiser than anyone else about what point we're at.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert. It's just these thoughts have been sort of developing over the last several years. You know, thinking about how political and cultural change happens and why the accepted explanations for such things seem to be lacking. You know, because when Trump was elected in 2016, when Brexit happened, the supporters of both said, oh, well, that's it. It's all sorted now. And actually, no, it wasn't, because, you know, as we've seen since then, whatever you think of Trump, he was, no, I'm not, you know, I like some of what he did, but, you know, some of the other stuff I'm not so sure about in terms of his effectiveness. His effectiveness was definitely curtailed by the permanent bureaucracy, you know, the administrative state just not go, just going, no, we're not going to do that, actually. You know, there was a concrete example of that was a one of the his military commanders basically said, well, yeah, we actually just lied to him about removing 200, you know, removing the Americans from Syria. We just left them there and just told them that we'd done it. You know, just as a small example of the kind of thing that happens. And in the UK, you know, we were facing, how long was it in the end? It seemed like forever at a time, because it just went on and on and on. The stymieing of the Brexit vote by, you know, it's an Americanism to call it a uniparty, but, you know, the sort of convergence of opinion from both sides of the House of Commons that Brexit, you know, shouldn't happen. And that's why, in the end, Boris Johnson had to call the election in 2019 to break the deadlock. So, you know, we've seen in the UK where you can vote for something as hard as you like and get it, and then it doesn't actually get implemented because the permanent state is not interested in implementing it because it goes against its own vision of what the good is. And this is something that a recent controversy here is this release of this book called Values, Voice, and Virtue by the professor Matt Goodwin, politics professor, which is all about this new, what he calls the new elite, which, you know, is very similar to some things that Joel Kotkin or Michael Lind have written about recently. Basically talking about the managerial class and their role in, pushing their own sort of double liberalism, social economic liberalism on everyone else through the arms of the organs of the state. He basically applied things that have already been written about in America to the British context. It's not completely out of the box, but he got so much pushback from people who are in this new elite, saying, oh, we're not part of this new elite. And it's because, you know, like with the goldfish in the water not knowing it's wet, you know, that's the same situation. And people say, oh, well, you've got a master's from King's College London, you know, you're in a new elite as well, or, you know, perhaps, but it's rather amusing seeing people who, you know, went to Oxbridge and, you know, Oxford and Cambridge, and then work in, you know, the prestige media saying they're not part of the elite which decides how things go. So, you know.
Yeah, I think this is an important kind of classification, and it's unfortunately kind of the core of our problems, because this is, you know, you have the high-low coalition, which is just an incredible force, and then you have a dwindling middle class that, you know, is essentially producing the seed corn.
Well, here, and, I mean, it's not even high-low. It's more as Professor Goodwin said, it's more the 20% versus the 80%, and so something that Michael Lind also talks about. We're sort of in the last few years have been particularly trying for the British economy in particular. So the middle class is being proletarianized, and the bottom, as it were, is facing pauperization. They're becoming pauperized by the inflation.
I think there's a different stratification in the UK than you see in the US.
It can't map one onto the other. This is the thing. It's like, yes, there are certain similarities between the scenarios, but this is why Brexit and Trump were not exactly the same thing. And this is why talking about stuff that happens in America, if you try and map that onto the British context, you know, in the same way, it doesn't work.
There's definitely an element of class that just is very incomprehensible in the US context, and it kind of splits the middle class as well in strange ways in the UK. I remember when I was in the UK myself, and I was working kind of in tech, and you could see there was kind of this divide between people in the same company, and you'd have people who were posh, and, you know, the marking of the posh person was that they would go on ski vacations with their parents when they were children. And that was the thing. And the people who were more from a working class background, who worked themselves up in the world to get to the point where they had this job, and they had, you know, the same job or maybe were even superior. So, but there was still this kind of lingering distance between, and you could see it almost kind of like a clustering of the more posh people with themselves and, you know, the lower class, a little bit of resentment there. It was very, very strange. And I remember someone who was more from a working class background kind of explained this whole thing to me. And it was just, I was completely oblivious to it because, you know, I come from Eastern Europe where there's only one class. I mean, there's only one class divide. You have money or don't you have money? Everyone's nouveau riche. There's no old money. There's no poshness. There's no nothing. No one's classy, to put it this way. So, yeah, it was really interesting. It felt kind of like this, you know, pop anthropology dose that I got from my colleague.
Yeah, and the thing is, just as Goodwin writes, the old elite class that you're talking about, they launder their position to fit with the new morality by adopting more, it's an annoying word, but sort of quote-unquote woke attitudes. Because this is one of the critiques about the analysis in Britain is that, well, you know, what are you talking about as a new elite? What about all these aristocrats and these, you know, millionaires and these rich people who still control levers of power and own all the land and all that kind of thing? Well, which is true, you know, there still is something of that, but the idea that, you know, the what used to be called the squirearchy, you know, the country squire and the local aristo has any sort of power to influence the way the culture evolves is just ridiculous. I mean, that went out in the 1960s, you know, I think it's 1963, might have been earlier. It was basically the beginning of the British satire boom with a show, that was the week that was. And, you know, that even then, the quote-unquote establishment that was making fun of was on the way out, you know, on the way down from its peak of power and influence. I think what you've seen is a sort of melding and almost hybridization of the old and the new. To sort of fit with an operator in the managerial world that we now live in. You know, your tech work company, that's an example. You know, you have, you know, the new economy with things like that, and then you have the two sets of people working together. And, you know, how do you get those people to rub along if they come from such different backgrounds? And I think this new sort of technocratic, managerial sort of attitude to life has been that binding agent, I guess. You know, because, you know, aristocratic virtue is not exactly the in thing, the coronation notwithstanding. But yeah, so I think it's in a bid to stay relevant and maintain some influence, I think the old smart set, you know, they adopt these, you know, so you've had Rob Henderson on your show, so luxury beliefs, you know, they adopt your luxury beliefs to keep up with the changing morality of the times, which by everything that they represent, they are, you know, they repudiate. You know, these people often have inherited wealth, and they come from, you know, stable backgrounds, and, you know, they have privilege in every sort of way that you could, under the new morality, you could choose. But if they adopt these positions, then they can maintain the best of both worlds, or at least they think they can. So,
yes, I think that it always struck me that if we didn't have wokeness or kind of this rabid egalitarianism, we'd kind of have to invent it with this economic system that we have, because it's, you know, it's the glue and lubricant that holds the whole thing together. You know,
It's strange because in some ways there was more social mobility up and down the social scale when Britain was supposedly a completely sort of static, hidebound feudal society. So, you know, much of when the British Empire was still going, the people who ran it were often not from. Of course, there were people who ran it who were of that upper class background, but also people who came up through the ranks because of their skill and their intelligence. And actually, there's been a strange, in Britain at least, there's been a strange inversion where the more meritocratic the rhetoric gets from the people in power, the less actual meritocracy there is. Because that's, you know, meritocracy threatens the people who have positions of power and influence. So why would you want that? And of course, this is why Peter Hitchens, the Doomer in chief of the British public life, he's written a book recently about the demise of what we call the grammar schools, which are these selective state education schools. They were basically wiped out, ironically, by a conservative government. But as he says, you know, of course, people in power want to wipe these schools out because they threaten their own children's possibility to climb the ladder. So, you know, if you remove the source of competition, then that's all to the good. Of course, it's all, as you said, it's all done under, you know, egalitarian rhetoric about fairness and, you know, equality and all that kind of stuff. But actually, by removing the chance to have somewhat of a infusion of talent into the elite through those means, you instead put the potential to move up and down the spectrum, the social scale, in the hands of just money. So, you know, instead of going to a school where it's selective, it's all based on selection for exams, it's based on selection for how much money you have to afford the house near the school cafeteria. So it's just as exclusive in some ways as it was. It's just done in a slightly less obvious way.
There's a lot of pressures on the liberal vision of meritocracy right now. I think, you know, there's one level, I mean, this is kind of Charles Murray's argument, you know, whatever one may think of it. It's the fact that, you know, the meritocracy has low-hanging fruit, and then you have a few generations of which that low-hanging fruit can be picked because people kind of self-select into relationships with each other, you know, this whole assortative mating.
Yeah, assortative mating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they go to the elite schools and they have children together and, you know, they only want to, you know, marry within their own class. On the other hand, you have all of this pressure because after, you know, you have one, two, three, four generations, let's say, especially in the U.S. After civil rights. And, you know, the idea there was that, okay, you're going to slowly equalize opportunities. And then once the opportunities are equalized, after one or two generations, you're probably going to end up somewhere close to equal outcomes. That's not happened. That's probably not going to happen, depending on what your perspective on this is. And it is political dynamite because you have a population which is essentially kind of relegated to this role. The left essentially is fueling a fire that's never going to be put out with the idea that, okay, you know, you're in this role because these people put you there and they keep you there through nefarious, you know, mysterious ways, which are only proven by the fact that you're still there. You know, if opportunities were equal, you wouldn't be there. You know, obviously they're sabotaging this. Obviously they're stealing from your children's mouths and you know, making this as apocalyptic a rhetoric as they can because this is the source of their power. So it's a tough time for meritocracy. And even, you know, the idea that this is going to be possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that being born with an inherited disability means that you have some illusions stripped away about the malleability of human nature. So, you know, people are born with different talents and temperaments and the ability to extend those to the utmost is not equal, obviously. But, you know, this is where the left's role in this makes me angry because I'm a big fan of Glenn Lowry. You know, his righteous rage is quite purifying about this kind of thing. Because, you know, yes, not everyone can do the same, obviously, because we're not blank slates and we're not all equally capable of things. You know, I'm not, because of my condition, I'm not physically capable of doing many things. But I think what angers me about the left is that it's rather than upholding standards, they destroy the standards as such, because standards themselves are racist or whatever. Which actually, as someone who had something of the of this to deal with in my own education, you know, sort of trying to, people in the education system here thinking that for me it was, it'd be better for me if they didn't push me as hard as other people, because, oh, it's better that he isn't, you know, it's better that we don't push him too hard because it's not going to be good for him. Well, actually the opposite was true, you know. The maintenance of common standards is actually the biggest sign of respect you can pay to people, because you're saying that we're not going to pander to you. We're, if you can't, you know, not everyone can meet the same standards, but having double standards instead is another way of saying that, you know, there's no point. You might as well just give up. And by the way, you giving up is actually the biggest strike against the racist, cis-heteronormative patriarchal system there is. So go, you know, get on with it. And I think that's just, there's something evil about that, actually.
Yeah, and corrupting.
It's corrupting, because it's
enticing the people. We know they're, it's giving them something they haven't earned, and by that, just kind of ruining the relationship with the whole institution. Yeah.
And it's not just giving them something they haven't earned; it's also driving a resentment that the mismatch between the rhetoric about where someone is in their life and why they are where they are. So, for instance, it could have been that I was just told by educators that, oh, well, it's fine. You know, just because you didn't do very well, it's not your fault. It's not that you didn't work hard enough. It's just because, you know, the system hates disabled people and we're just going to give you a free pass anyway because you deserve it because of all the suffering you've been through. Which is essentially, it's a really simplified way of putting it, but that's essentially the argument across whole domains of life nowadays. And actually, as someone who's had a little bit of that in my own life, I can say that it crushes the spirit out of you if you let it, because it's condescending and patronizing you in the extreme, because it's treating you as someone less than, in the name of compassion. You know, it was this sort of weaponized empathy, and weaponized compassion. It's actually a form of cruelty in the end, because it just leaves the people, in the end, it leaves the people who are treated in this way in a worse position than they would be if you just tried to, you know, maintain the standards that you set for everyone else. So, of course, there'll be people in the audience who think I'm being all starry-eyed about people's ability to do and achieve certain things. But, you know, I think
it's a
complicated subject, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, there's also this assumption that everyone should be able to do everything.
Yeah.
And it is an insane assumption. I mean, there's never been anything more utopian. You know, I understand in the sense that, you know, you don't want to bar access to competent people to things that might be socially productive for everyone. But the idea that, you know, even this concept of like, okay, how many female CEOs are there and things like that, like, you know, CEO is some form of nobility title that you just access one day. Being a CEO is a you know, backbreaking, you know, high stress labor.
Yeah.
It's not some, you know, it's not like, you know, you are now CEO, go home and enjoy your paycheck. It's an incredibly, you know, pressure filled thing that only very few people in the world are qualified for. And it's just, you know, we're treating this as, yeah, I don't know, as like a ticket to Disneyland. And it really isn't the case. And this is just the case for any sort of excellence in any field. It's mostly blood, sweat, and tears. And the fact that, you know, there's great compensation package, or I don't know, you get a Nobel Prize at the end. It really doesn't mean that it's just a, you know, all upside.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the sort of woke identitarianism where your one sense of self and self-worth is gained through endless navel-gazing and introspection about one's identity. It doesn't help you form a sense of identity and self, because, you know, forming a sense of identity and self is done by inculcation into a culture and a tradition and a way of life, but also through action and through the exercise of one's agency. You know, this is what Hannah Arendt said. You show who you are to yourself by what you do and to other people, and that's how you form your sense of place in the world. So, you know, just sitting around thinking about who am I and why is the world treating me so badly, it's not going to get you anywhere. And I can say this from personal experience. You know, when I was younger, I'm 29 now, but when I was, you know, my teenage years, I sometimes would give into sort of, oh, well, you know, life is so unfair. Why was I born this way? Why is the world so mean? You know, blah, blah, blah. And that didn't actually help. You know, it actually made things worse. And the feeding of that temptation by someone on the left as a way of gaining power for themselves, I just think is disgusting. So that's, you know, it's a pretty basic thing to say for these circles. But I think it undermines the people who they are claiming to help, obviously, but it also undermines the possibility of a stable and harmonious society where people fit themselves to their talents and the temperament that they're born with and then do something productive. Because, you know, if you undermine the possibility of that even, then society just falls apart. And I think we're seeing that. What is it, Daniel Patrick Moynihan saying, you know, defining deviancy down, oh, bad behavior, that's fine. It's the system. That's why you behave like you do, not your actual, the actual choices you made in spite of, or in the, you know, in, you might find yourself in a set of circumstances, but it's how you react to that. That's who you, you know, that's part of what defines you as a person.
There's something to the fact that a lot of the pressures that we used to have, and the things that kind of drew us together as communities, and the things that kept tradition alive, and, you know, just the contact with base reality itself, I think has drifted away for a lot of people. So
absolutely,
the idea that identity, you know, doesn't grow out of the things you mentioned, out of, you know, community and tradition and a way of life. It's much more understandable now, because it really is kind of like a menu. We were just used to, you know, engaging with the world on a click basis and just studying, you know, what do the people that I like? So I am that type of person. And it's just a, you know, it's a very inhuman way of relating to yourself, yeah, and others.
I mean, I had a thought the other day, which I wrote down. The liberal right, its ethic is consumption, and the liberal left, is the ethic is sort of moral redistribution. So the right has given up on largely on religion and hierarchy and community and tradition and history and country, and it's all come down. It's legitimating. Morality is the ability to consume and to gain more pleasure than pain from the market. And that has now broken down because of various structural issues. So that means that the one thing that the mainstream right, particularly in the UK, has used to justify itself is now not there. Whereas the left, its attack on the foundations of what makes a society work and what makes life worth living, in the name of distributing moral you know, morality to those who deems more, who it deems now more worthy than those who monopolized it in the past in an evil way. That in itself just drives the division between groups, which are tricky enough to handle anyway, without putting these poisonous, without driving these wedges into the mix, which make it even harder to find any common ground. And some in the audience will say, "Well, there can't be common ground anyway." I'm not arguing for a utopia where everyone gets along, because that's never happened and it never will, because we're human beings and we're tribal. I'm literally just talking about basic social order. And in America, you know, that's sort of breaking down in the name of, you know, equity and inclusion. And in the UK, there's sort of a background hum of low level sort of disorder now. It's more noticeable than it was. And this is, you know, it's part of the reason is that, oh, well, these people, you know, people who disrupt the public space are doing it, you know, these people who are doing it, they're doing it for just causes. So it's these two new ethics for the left and right, you know, the ethic of consumption, the ethic of moral redistribution, they're both acids eating at the foundations of what makes society makes society possible.
Yes, and I don't know. It's the UK seems to be a very devitalized place, yeah, in the sense that, you know, the things that actually draw people to it are just have been left to rot in a way that is just shocking to someone who's coming from abroad.
Yeah, and you saw what could be when the Queen died last year, and briefly around the coronation this year. And of course, again, I know there'll be skeptics in the audience who'll go, "Oh well, you're just, you know, it's just copium." But it's, and actually, I'll just say something about that attitude, because I've seen it on Twitter among more anonymous rights. You know, this is all just there's something about this. It's like, I know things are bad, and I'm not, how should I say it? I'm not unaware of how bleak things can look. I've written about it quite a lot, so, you know, I'm not denying it. But there's something about some on the anonymous right and some on the left, you know, they sort of mirror the left and thinking, oh, well, this enjoyment of people just enjoying things is a form of false consciousness that somehow, you know, the black pill can be quite poisonous, I think. Even when bleakness is appropriate, which I think it is in quite a lot of things at the moment. But I don't think it was false consciousness which drove people to queue to get to see the Queen lying in state, for instance. I mean, I did that. And somebody said that the closest analog they could think of was some sort of religious pilgrimage. Because it was a mass thing, it was a mass event, greatly inconveniencing people, and they did it because it spoke to something higher, and something deep within the human soul that is called out to you by something like this. And again, you know, the coronation. Yes, there was stuff that people would, some on the right would find it less than it ought to be, but I don't know. Ed West wrote a good piece about it. He said it's the one time that the conservative, you know, if you're a conservative, you felt like you were winning in the culture, because it was something that, you know, the people who actually want to tear down the monarchy, they are so cringe and low status that it feels like there's something there. It feels like a flame that's almost gone out, but if you breathe it into life again, it might come back in some way. And again, you know, this may all be delusion. But I think despair is a sin. You know, I'm a believing Christian. I think despair is a sin, and hope is not easy. But times like this, times like the Queen's funeral and the coronation, I felt there was some reason to hope. But there's something salvageable, you know.
I agree. I think that's a really important viewpoint that maybe I don't underline as much on the show, though I should. You know, the total black pill and the constant perspective. I mean, there's an incentive online because it is very hard to put forward a positive vision just because you're on the hook for it once you've put it forward to have a completely negative perspective. And you can build the whole platforms on tearing things down. And I feel like there's such a huge role for gratitude, especially for people who are Christians or aspiring Christians like myself.
You'll get there.
Thank you. It is transformative, and it's also, you know, that's kind of in a way one of the core emotions that drove me to even be in a place like the UK in the first place. I mean, obviously, money and career opportunities are one thing, but at the same time, I wanted to be in the UK because I was grateful for the existence of this cradle of civilization that accepted me as to be part of it, to participate in its culture. And maybe a lot of my so-called red pilling and radicalization has been the fact that my gratitude was, you know, not reciprocated. At least I didn't find a counterpart there. It was, you know, they were being ungrateful for what they had. And it was really painful.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's this thing that Roger Streeton called the culture of repudiation. Repudiating all the things that make life worth living and give it meaning and purpose. And I think my anger at this push is made stronger by, if you have a condition like mine, which is, how should I say, it limits life in all sorts of ways, let's put it like that. Things like the inheritance of the past and gratitude for what you've been given and the feeling of being part of a stream of history which you've been born into, to have that, it's almost more important to be able to participate in such a thing when you have a more challenging life as a result of unchosen circumstances. And this is something I wrote about on the anniversary of Streeton's death. It's being born with a hereditary condition like mine means, you know, I could have gone one way. I could have gone, oh well, screw all the unchosen, screw the past, reject what's been handed down, because why should I feel any gratitude for that when it doesn't help me cope with this? Well, actually, the opposite's true. The feeling of being part of something bigger that stretches backwards and forwards in time, feeling like you're part of something sacred, it is almost more necessary. It is more necessary when you're born, as I am, with something that is more of a trial than just sort of we're all, as people, we're all asking the fundamental questions about our, you know, who am I, why am I here? What's my purpose? Those questions are urgent anyway, if you're born just with a normal body in a normal situation. If you're someone like me with, to be blunt, skin that doesn't work, and a briefer time span in which to enjoy these things and to explore and to experience life, the feeling of connection to something greater than yourself is so much more important than it is given credit for by even the supporters of such a worldview today. And I can't bear the efforts to burn it all down by the left or some on the left, because there are some people on the left in the UK. It's not quite, again, this is something different between the UK and the US. There are some on the left who are, you know, post-liberal leftists who don't just want to burn it all down. But, you know, the people who just think it's all evidence of oppression and evil, so it all has to go. And it's so much richer to engage with these things that we didn't do but are ours because we're born into them. To rediscover them in an age like ours when so much is being liquefied by the market and the morality of the day, which is almost an anti-morality. You know, we shouldn't have to feel like we have to search for these things, but the search for me has been a fulfillment which, you know, has given life a sense of purpose and meaning, which just living for the next hedonic hit of pleasure from, you know, the online world or whatever, it's priceless. And the wish to tear that all down is just, it's something almost incomprehensible to me. You know, I know academically why they do it, but yeah, that's why I don't just sit at home writing these things for myself. That's why, you know, people, it might not seem very much in the way of action to just write things and send them off to places, but, you know, I could just sit at home and not do anything, you know, and the culture today would say, oh, well, you know, you've got a disability, that's fine. But if you don't match principle with action, then in some ways it means you're a lesser person. And, you know, that's the life of course, we're all fallen creatures. We live in a broken world. But that doesn't mean that you give up striving as such for some form of virtue in life.
Yes, you make an excellent point that I think a lot of people on the left and maybe even people on the right don't necessarily grasp in its immensity, that, you know, what the left is doing, this liquefaction of everything that we used to hold us up as a society and each individual as well. I mean, all the patterns of life that existed for a reason is a theft on a scale that, you know, you're stealing from the past by desecrating your ancestors and throwing their, you know, statues on a pyre and, you know, just erasing their history. And even more so, you're stealing from the future because these things have value. And, you know, I think your example is someone who, you know, feels these values maybe more immediately because, you know, you can't just throw yourself into the day-to-day things. You know, you have to have a considered existence because you're considering your existence on this earth because it is you are an outlier and you have to deal with that. I think that's, you know, it's a very important perspective, and I'm happy that you're kind of in the space with us and you're thinking about these ideas in a very profound way. And I know we're slowly coming up on time. I want to ask you the last question, the question of the show.
Yes.
Which is, the subversive thinker question. If you have any recommendations for our listeners.
Sure. So I've got two, actually. Firstly, the theorist of the nation, Anthony D. Smith. He is probably the best person to read if I'm looking at my bookcase now. That's why I'm looking down. He's probably the best person to read if you want a academically rigorous but readable take on the nation and nationalism in a theoretical way. He goes through the historiographical debates about what a nation is and what nationalism is and where each come from. He himself comes down. He comes down on the side of this theory called ethno-symbolism, which is about basically a particular people in a particular place creates a myth symbolic complex, which then expresses their sense of themselves. Which then isn't. It's not. It's for me. It strikes the balance between particularity denying universalism and a universalism denying sort of ethnocentrism, which doesn't brook any possibility of exchange between people. And then the other, so I'll just finish on him. His textbook, Nationalism, is just called Nationalism. I think that's a good starting point. Yoram Hazony cites it, I think, and Eric Kaufman is inspired by Anthony Smith as well. And then the other thinker I think people would find valuable, and I found valuable, is a Swedish-American writer called, now I'm not sure about the pronunciation, so forgive me if it's wrong, but Claes G. Rinn. So Claes is spelled C-L-A-E-S, and then Rinn is R-Y-N. So he has written a few books, one about called America the Virtuous, which is about the what he calls the new Jacobins, who are the people who think that America is just an idea and that you can spread the idea all over the world through the barrel of a gun. So hence new Jacobins, because they're the modern equivalent of the French revolutionaries. And against this, he presents the history of what he calls constitutional democracy, which is about, you know, restraint of the lower self in service to the higher self. And that restraint means that you can live in a virtuous way together in a functioning society with a properly run government. And then his other book, which I would recommend, it's been probably the most influential on me, is I think it's called A Higher, where is it? Sorry about this. Here we go. A Common Human Ground, and it's basically his thoughts on the synthesis between moral universality and cultural particularity, and it's basically boiling it down to simplifying it in a horrible, simplistic way, but it's the idea that you can only appreciate and apprehend moral universality through the particularity of your time and space. I think part of the problem, this is something he says, part of the problem with the left today is that they deny any possibility of interaction between the universal and the particular. So you get, you know, the postmodern left who say that reality is a social construction and it's all about power discourses, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas Rinn shows that we, through our own particular circumstances, we appreciate the moral universality of the of our place in the world and our relationship with each other through those particulars. And that is essentially what Eben Burke was talking about back in the 18th century. And it's what conservatism and more right-wing thought is interpreting in its own way, you know, in all the different ways. I think those two authors, Anthony Smith and Claes Rhyn, would be, I think people would find them profitable reading them.
Excellent. Yeah, I think this is unique and new to me recommendations, which is always a good thing,
that's
which
good.
I appreciate.
That's good.
Yes, I think, and then extremely interesting as well. I mean, this is probably the major tension of our time, and I think any sort of
exactly.
theoretical help with this with helps anyone interested in politics and what it might look like. So I want to thank you again for coming on, Henry. This has been lovely. And I want to point people to your work. You're on Twitter at IntoTheFuture45.
Yep.
Is there any other thing that you'd like people to have a look at?
So I'm speaking at the National Conservatism Conference in London on All Being Well on May the 16th. So that should be up by the time this goes out on YouTube, hopefully.
Yes.
I write in a variety of places. Some of them are on my Twitter bio. Just go to that and you'll see them. My main output is at this American site called Merion West, Merion West. One of my thoughts has been worked out there. And then more recently, The Critic and The European Conservatives. So if people go to those places, they'll get a good idea of where I'm, how I've developed and where I'm coming from.
Excellent. Excellent. And I do want to encourage people to read your essays and watch your speech, your upcoming one and the one from Brussels.
The one from last year. Yeah. Thank you. Well, a lot of the stuff we talked about here was put there in condensed form. So people might find that interesting as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Henry.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you'd like to support my work and access more content, please consider subscribing through Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. See you next week.